before. Head game, chest gang, it's the same, you know. Niggas got high hopes, but they aim is low. Stay paid, never broke, that's a personal model. When I say you run numbers, every verse is a lotto. Like coke in the 80s, I make the streets crazy. My name's singing the mouth of all the fly ladies. Cause I'm just a nigga who's on the mic. And when I rock the party right, it's your bitch's delight. You was welcome, so don't get mad, I'm really trying to help them. It's highly inappropriate, so cook, you gotta tell them. We pull up in your city, run your pockets for the stimmy. With bamboo knockers in my ears, say you gimme. It's easy, money dripping from me like it's greasy. Feeling like the coldest winter ever when you see me.
Well, all right, all right, all right. What's up, everybody? It's me, your girl, Cook, and I'm here. It is a whole week after my birthday. Thank you very kindly. Thank you very kindly. I had a blast. I had fun. And I just want to say today's show is brought to you by Ray Charles and Cookies and Cream. And something else when I forgot. Yeah, so that's why we're here. Anyway, so my birthday was last week. I started last Sunday. I went out with my good girlfriend, and we went to see my band, and we partied. I shook my tail feather, and then we went to IHOP because if you know me, you know after I finished partying a night of drinking and getting faded, I go home, I end the night with some IHOP. And this African man was flirting with me in the IHOP. I should go back too, because he might give me some free pancakes. Then Monday, I recorded with Mocha Minute, because you know that's my boo. And that's what I do. I record with her because I enjoy it. I love her. If you're not listening to Mocha Minute, you are tripping because Stephanie's amazing. And then Tuesday, shout out to my girl Shauna. It was her birthday, so we ate tacos on the rooftop. It was real classy based or whatever, and we hung out and we had girl talk, and it was just really nice to sit down with a friend, somebody, you know, we could really let our hair down and just be ourselves. And it was like fire because we're Sagittarius. That was amazing. And then Wednesday, my actual birthday. So I really didn't want to like do something for my birthday. I wanted to do what I normally do, which is I've been doing it since my 20th birthday. I usually throw a dinner party and like eat and hang out with my friends. So I was supposed to do it that Saturday, but then one of my cousins reminded me that we didn't get a chance to celebrate our birthday because her birthday is the 27th, which is like right after Thanksgiving, but she's in Jamaica. So she was like, she come back, we gonna party. And I was like, you're right. I did commit to that. So for my birthday, I just made a big meal because that's what I do. I fried some shrimp and I made some dirty rice and some broccoli, sprinkled some cheese on it, and a bitch made cupcakes. So that was dinner. But for brunch, because you know a bitch brunches, my plug came through, the plug and his wife came through. They brought bubbly, they brought me drinks that were infused, and we rolled up bud. And I made an egg scramble with some veggies, like some red peppers, yellow pepper, orange pepper, some onion. And I scrambled it up real good in the eggs because that's how I roll. And then I made some corned beef hash because me and the plug eat corned beef hash because we real niggas. And I made some bacon, and then I made some salmon. So that was like our little brunch or whatever. And we ate, and then we smoked, and I got fucked up. Like, well, no, I didn't really get fucked up, but it was a smoking event. It was a lot of smoke in the air, and I was very proud. When you know when you're in the session with your friends and you're talking, and everybody's, you know, kicking it, and then you look around the room, and it's like this room is like one big cloud. Good times. good times. I made a cloud in my house, and that was really pretty much what I needed to do. So then some other friends came through, hit a J, left, went back to work or whatever they was going to do. And then I got up and made dinner, and then my friends came through for dinner, ate, and then we went downstairs and we had a smoke session, and we just smoked and drank. I put one of them niggas to bed. Because niggas think they can hang, but no, I'm joking. No, it was all good. It was fun. I'm glad I did it. And then they left, and then I smoked a couple more J's because it was my birthday. I smoked all day long on my birthday. And I ended the night and I passed out. I was out. It was done. And then Thursday, the next day, was spent recovering from the day before. It, no bullshit. I don't think I came down from my birthday until like Saturday. Because Saturday, I was going to get up and like go out and do things. I did not. I did not. And then Sunday, to close out my week, my other good friend took me to brunch and we went to Clout and it was delicious. I had the French toast and I had French toast eggs and the honey garlic wings, because they do like a waffle chicken waffle combo, but they also have a French toast chicken combo. So I did the French toast and the honey garlic wings. Bitch, that shit was delicious. And we drank. I had mimosa. I had a mango cranberry mimosa. I did not trust them to make my Bloody Mary. Full disclosure, that's why I did not order one. I know I was supposed to order a Bloody Mary to toast with my friends, but no, I didn't trust them to make my Bloody Mary. And I stand on that. I didn't trust them. I didn't trust they would do it right. So that was my week. That was my birthday. All that celebrating. And to my friends, I am going to do a redo. We are going to get together. We are going to have good times and we're going to drink. It's going to be later in the month. I'm celebrating all month, but I got one more shindig in me before 2022 comes. I got one more shindig in me before 2022 comes. And then, yes. One more shindig. And then yes, 2022 will be the year of rest and relaxation. I'm claiming it now. And I hope you all can figure out what you want to do for 2022 and you get it done and it works for you. Cause I love y'all. You know, I want y'all to be y'all best. And I want everybody to enjoy the fruits of their labor and be at peace. You know, everyone under the sound of my voice, be at peace. Okay, so it is so much going on in the world, y'all. It's so much happening. So let's get into what I have for you all. I have some stories and some articles in here, y'all. We're going to go through the whole thing. If it takes us 2 hours, the fuck we fitting to do, y'all? Buckle up. Buckle up. Because motherfuckers is wilding. People are wilding. Shit is wild out here. Wow. Okay. So this first story, let me tell y'all something. I don't know. I have information on the Oxford High School shooter. I have information on his parents. I'm gonna start with him. Let me just get this out of the way, because at first I was like, I don't know, blah, blah, blah. But let me say something. One thing about this story, given the information that we know about the parents and their involvement or what they knew leading up to this, I think this is a gross case of negligence. A gross case of negligence and just poor parenting, poor adulting, poor thinking, poor decision making. It's the whole situation reeks of poverty. Okay, it's poor, piss poor. Because what we know is that first and foremost, this father purchased this gun on Black Friday. purchases the gun, brings the gun home, allows the son not only to have access to the gun, but did not secure the gun. And did not even check to follow up to see if the gun was where he left it. I believe these parents knew the son had the gun. I believe they bought it for him. And I believe they didn't care. And you know what I also believe? I also believe they were influenced by Kyle Rittenhouse's case. And I'm going to go ahead and call a thing a thing. I really do. Because there's no way for those parents to be that lax when the basic rules of gun ownership in multiple states is it's under the requirement that you keep that gun under lock and key and away from minors. And thank God that Michigan actually has that law on the fucking books, because that's how they were able to get them on the negligence and manslaughter. Because in Michigan state law, you have to secure firearms away from minors and make the effort to do that. It has to be demonstrated, and they did not. I'm glad they are getting them on terrorism, because he terrorized those children. I'm thankful that those children had the thought process to ask the questions, but because that child did those security drills with those children, he knew what to say, but he fucked up when he said bro, and them kids was like, nah, and they was out. And you know what? It's fucked up that that's how our children have to think when they go to school. But you know what? If it's good enough for white people, fuck it. Clearly, you know, and I'm still not over, you know what? I'm not over the fact that Sandy Hook happened. And I knew when it happened, I said to myself, oh, we're going to get comprehensive gun legislation now. Them little white children got wholesale slaughtered. And when nothing happened, I knew. And as you can see, ever since then, it's just been escalating more and more. And in the African-American community, yes, we have issues with gun violence. But we're not out here mass murdering people like school shooters are doing. This is a thing, and this is important. And I'm sorry, but I would like to see stop and frisk implemented on young white males. Make sure they don't have no firearms. Whatever laws we got on the books, I want to see y'all implement that on them. I want to see more white parents being held accountable for their children shooting up schools. And I'm sorry, but whether the parents knew or not, I want it to be a law moving forward. If your child shoots up a school, you, mom and dad, y'all going to jail too. Lock everybody up. Lock the whole goddamn family up. Because looking at the text messages where the child was doing things already, and the school already had concern about his behavior and him acting out and showing violent tendencies and making drawings, and them telling the parents that, you know, that morning of the shooting, they said, you have to take him to be evaluated within 48 hours. And they chose to leave him in school. They did not check to see if he had the gun. And a few hours later, he murdered four people. Yeah. And then them hoes fled. I don't give a fuck what nobody say. They was all apologizing to the court, blah, blah, blah. You know what? I wanted to be a fly on the wall. Well, whoever found them and was like, bro, you got to turn yourself in. Come on. I don't know if it was their attorneys or what. But motherfuckers was scrambling. Like, no, they didn't flee. And here's another thing about this. Okay, so wait a minute. Because I want to touch on this. Because when I thought, I was like, what the entire fuck? These motherfuckers went to the ATM and withdrew $4,000, is being reported. And I want to know, what ATM lets you withdraw $4,000? What kind of ATM does that? Because I can't take no more than $400 out of my bank when I go to the ATM. What kind of bank were these people at where they could take out $4,000 cash and it was from the ATM? I want to know. And I want that policy stopped. I want that bank shut down. Because no. And the funny part, so they drove to Detroit and their artist friend, some guy probably owns a gallery or some shit, like an artist in a commercial building is what they kept saying. Like, no, that's that motherfucker's art gallery that he owned and shit. The nigga had money and they was about to fucking abscond, okay? And help, they rich from was going to help them. So he was like, oh no, I'm not going to get caught up in the bullshit. But bro, I need you to check your priorities as a person. Why would you help your friends flee after they were part of a mass murder and didn't stop it? So that's interesting. Yeah. I think also after these types of shootings, I think all the family assets should be frozen so that, yeah, they can't flee. everything needs to be frozen and everything needs to be taken out of the home. Mom, devices for the parents to see what they knew, what they didn't knew, figure it out, find out soon, because I bet you 9 times out of 10, even if we go back to Columbine, I bet you they fucking knew to some extent. And I think that says something about white parenting. They literally let their children do whatever they want, because when that boy was making that drawing in school and the teacher called and the parents came in and the mom's going to text him, "I'm not mad at you, son. Like, I'm not mad at you. Like, just don't get caught." Like, really, bitch? Throw that bitch under the jail. But manslaughter for me, it's proper. It is proper, but they need to do the maximum for manslaughter. Because yes, it was involuntary manslaughter. I mean, like, yeah, their inactions and pretty much actionless actions led to people dying. So that is involuntary manslaughter, being reckless because they were the adults in the situation. But they shouldn't see the light of day for a while. And put them in gin pop. And you know me, put these motherfuckers in gin pop. Motherfucking gin pop. And another thing I'm waiting for, the state may not go after Kyle Rittenhouse, but the feds better. The feds better go after his mama for buying that gun across state lines and letting him go with it, buying him the gun in the first place he wasn't supposed to have. The feds better come after that bitch and lock her wrinkled neck up. I mean that shit. If the feds don't do shit, I want all the alphabets on her ass. ATF, DEA, every motherfucking baddie. Drop squad on that bitch. And lock her up, throw her in the feds. Period. And those are my thoughts and my comments on that situation, because that was a lot. Just having a high schooler, even being the home, and I forgot what was going on. I think it might have been 4th of July or something. And I was making a joke like, "Oh, they, you know, get down there and let off fireworks outside." And my daughter was just like, "Girl, if this was a real shooting, you'd have got shot. Like, you ain't do that right at all." And I'm like, "What?" And I'm like, "You do shooter drills in your school?" She's like, "Yeah." And I was like, "Wow, I didn't know." Like, they did not alert the parents that they do active shooter drills. Like, before, they used to send notifications home and tell you, like, "Oh, we're having a fire drill, blah, 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 blah." Because me growing up, that's what we did. We did fire drills. Period. Like, there were no. I'm like, it wasn't the 50s where it was nuclear bomb threat, so you did bomb drills and shit. It was always fire drills. Now these kids are doing active shooter drills. And I used to do them online at work. I do active shooter drills, you know, recertification. Like, we have to do that, like the fight, flight, or fear act or whatever, like, you know, in the event of an active shooter, like, you know, what you should do. But I'm like, in the cubicle environment, 9 times out of 10, I don't worry about active shooters because I take 2-hour lunches. Let me tell you something, pop off during lunch because I ain't going to be there. You know, and I'm not an asshole on the job anyway, and I don't bother people, so I don't really worry about that, even though that don't mean shit. I'm just saying. Cubicle life, shit. Shit. I wasn't in the building, no way. I'm not even going to hold you. Woo. But now that school's back in session, we're back to mass shootings. And I have a lot of thoughts on that, and it's a lot. But let's get into this story here, because also your children are committing espionage in school. Now, we saw that wonderfully cute TikTok or tweet or in Twitter, the video where the lady found out that her son was disabling the school Wi-Fi and subsequently causing school to be closed so he didn't have to go to school, which yes, please. If you're a hacker and you happen to hear this message, I'm asking you, if you're going to hack, please do something really useful for the people, like hack Navy and Sally Mae and wipe out everybody's student loan debt. Or matter of fact, just clear it. Like, scramble it and clear it so they can never find it, because fuck that. Also, if you could just, you know, like, clear, like, go, no, nah, I'm sorry, no.
I'm going to stop right there.
Because if 12 is listening, y'all ain't coming for me. Fuck y'all. Try again, bitch. But if somebody do it, you know, I don't know nothing about that. Allegedly. But anyway, we have another hacking story. But let me tell y'all what these hoes did. Let me tell y'all about these children. On March 15, four police cruisers pulled up to a modest brick house in the sleepy town of Cantonment. That's Cantonment. What is this, Central Florida? Where in Florida is Cantonment? If anybody knows, is it close to Jacksonville? Is it close to Miami? Is it close to Opa-locka? Like, because those are the only three places I really know about Florida, wherever niggas be. Anyway, Cantonment, Florida, to arrest two accused hackers. The cops fanned out SWAT team style around the home, stationing themselves at the front, back, and side doors. They pounded on windows and demanded the alleged cyber crooks show their faces, according to witnesses and court documents. Out came an unlikely pair. Laura Carroll, a petite 50-year-old elementary school vice principal, and her 17-year-old daughter, Emily Grover, a popular local tennis star and a student at nearby Tate High School. You are 50 and you have a 17-year-old, bitch. I could never. 50? 17? Oh, no. But whatever. Let me mind my business. You know, I'm not here to bash anyone's uterine journey. You know, like, your journey is your business and shit. Just couldn't be. Let me shut the fuck up before somebody fuck around knock me up and I will. Oh, my God. Then I have to throw myself down the steps. Y'all, that's just terrible. So police cuffed the woman, and at one point, Carroll begged them to let her put on a bra before hauling her away to jail, she said. The teen was taken to a juvenile detention center. 8 months later, they both faced 16 years in prison, a punishment harsher than what some high-level ransomware attackers and corporate data thieves receive. But the pair stands accused of a more bizarre crime, hacking into a school computer system to rig a homecoming election in Grover's favor. Yes, these bitches pull. What was the name of that movie back in the day with Denise Richards and Kirstie Alley and Kirsten Thompson? What is her name? Oh, I forgot her name. It was Ellen Burke. And what is her name? She was in Interview with a Vampire. She was a little girl and she was in Bring It On. So Kirsten Dunst, her. Y'all remember? When they were in the pageant, they were going back and forth. She blew her mother up. I cannot remember the name of that movie, but if anybody can remember it, please tell me what it was. Please remind me what that shit was. But this is giving me that vibe right here. Y'all, they hacked the homecoming election so this bitch could be homecoming queen, which, oh my God. So, and now they are facing 16 years in prison, and this is, I'm gagged. So the alleged cheat for glory could have ended up with a slap on the wrist if it weren't for local parents' fears, investigators' ambitions, and the pair's own stubbornness. According to hundreds of pages of court documents and interviews with people involved, the duo has refused a no-jail plea agreement, and the case is now headed to trial as soon as January, their lawyer said. In an interview, the women tell me they've become town pariahs who rarely leave the house and are desperately trying to repair their reputation, and they have no plans to back down. We're not pleading guilty to something we didn't do, Carroll said. If there was any crime committed, the punishment doesn't fit. For us, the most important thing is clear our name and to let the whole honest story come out. Dear Grover's family, friends, and teachers tell it she was a beloved athlete who worked hard to overcome attention deficit disorder, only to become ensnared in a tech mix-up and made into a sacrificial lamb. To hear law enforcement and school officials tell it, Grover and her mother tarnished the dignity of the time-honored homecoming tradition, rattled parents, and caused a legitimate computer security threat to hundreds of students. To win the crown, investigators say Grover got dozens of students' ID numbers and birth dates from a district-wide computer system using her vice principal mom's login. The pair then allegedly cast at least 246 fake votes for the teen on Carroll's cell phone and a computer at their home through Election Runner, a third-party app used by the school. And you bitches don't know how IP addresses or GPS tagging works at all, because my God. Logging in with your mom's credentials to get the student names and birthday. Jesus Christ. Bye, y'all. Bye. This is not hacking. This is not hacking. What did they hack? They didn't hack. Like, what? Okay. Let me shut up. We must continue. Caroline Gray, a student council teacher in charge of the homecoming vote, was first to spot something fishy. According to court documents, on the morning of October 30 of 2020, the day Grover was crowned at an elaborate ceremony, Gray noticed the AB had flagged dozens of false votes. Gray, who was known for being a dedicated educator, earned the school's Teacher of the Year award in 2017. Despite her good relationship with Grover, she was suspicious about the invalid votes cast in the team's favor, according to her deposition. So she called at least four students, including a boy who had supposedly cast his vote at 4 a.m. to see if their votes were legit. Some of those students told her they hadn't voted. Others said they tried but got a message from the AB saying they'd already voted, according to investigators. So Gray reported the suspicious data to then Superintendent Malcolm Thomas, who made the call to let Grover receive the award anyway, according to court documents. The AB had reported fraudulent votes on a smaller scale in the past, and a winner had to be named in time for the ceremony that night. Gray declined to comment through a school district spokesman. At around 11:50 a.m., the teacher also received an unsolicited text message from Grover saying she'd heard someone was like cheating or hacked the system like earlier in the morning, according to investigators. Oh my God. They always return to the scene of the crime. I ain't even gonna hold you. Motherfuckers always return to the, motherfuckers who did the dirt always return to the scene of the crime. I ain't even gonna hold you. I'm gonna leave it right there. The school announced Grover Queen, and soon she was ready for her close-up. Sporting a glittery dress and blonde hair, she flashed a smile as she clutched a bouquet of red roses at the homecoming ceremony. Photos from the local news site show her dad, Bubba Grover, escorted her across a school football field while dressed in a three-piece tuxedo and bow tie as fans in the stands cheered. His name's Bubba. Winning meant the world to Grover, who had previously considered herself an outcast on campus, she told me. I came here freshman year as the new girl. Most people at my high school went to the same middle school and had been friends forever. So a lot of the girls didn't like me because of that, she said. Finally, by senior year, she said, I was very liked. People liked me. She wasn't the only person in Cantonment wrapped up in the status, tradition, and pageantry of the event. For many families in the military-centric For many families in the military-centric Pensacola suburb of about 26,000 people, where teenage football players and cheerleaders are treated like borderline celebrities, homecoming is the town's Oscar night, locals told me. Yeah, you people need to find something better to do with your time, and that's a part of the problem. High school worship, teenage culture. Ooh, I have commentary. Along with earning respect and admiration, homecoming queens garner glowing local news write-ups and take home a glittering crown as a trophy. But the vote has always been known to irk some parents and inflame local politics, which tends to be split geographically between wealthy North Enders and poor folks on the south side of town, according to locals. It's definitely a Southern thing. Homecoming is huge down here, Carol said. Explaining the area is culturally closer to Alabama than Florida. Culturally closer to Alabama than Florida. And she said that with her whole chest too. It's a huge expense and a lot of effort for what is basically a popularity beauty contest. That night, not everybody was pleased that Grover had won. There were some angry moms, Carol said. The runner-up was born to be homecoming queen. Her mama was probably a homecoming queen. She's a cheerleader, blonde and sweet and dingy. An anonymous tip came to the Escambia County School District's fraud and abuse hotline the next day, which was Halloween. The mystery tipster claimed Grover had used the district's Focus account, a computer system where students can see their grades, attendance, and disciplinary records to rig the election. The district's chief investigator, Gary Marsh, quickly began probing the hot tip. According to court documents, he discovered 372 student records had been viewed through Carol's account in the past 14 months, 339 of which were from Tate High School, according to court papers. The teen had logged in to get the names and dates of birth of people used for voting, the tipster reported, according to Marsh. When questioned in a deposition later, Marsh said he couldn't remember if the tip had come in via email or phone. A lawyer for the woman, Randy Etheridge, called the tip hearsay and suspects it may have come from someone within the school district. Don't matter. Y'all here now. Marsh, a former internal naval crimes investigator, has a reputation for being a bulldog, said Carroll, who worked at Bellevue Elementary School, not far from the high school. When he's coming on campus, someone is losing a job. The endpoint is never good. So when he demanded answers from Carroll, she initially clammed up and denied that she or anyone else had looked at the accounts. Marsh said in a deposition, eventually she admitted to letting her daughter use her login because hers wasn't working. He said, asked why so many student profiles have been accessed through her account. She couldn't provide any explanation about the vast numbers. Carroll wasn't exactly helpful when questioned by Brian Johnson, the district's computer security manager, either. It was not a pleasant interview, he said in a deposition. My question about the information security training, I think her response was, I don't pay attention to that bullshit. Marsh and Johnson both declined to comment. So investigators began digging around elsewhere. And on November 4th, they interviewed at least 9 students generating witness statements that read like a cross between screenplays for Gossip Girl and Law and Order. I'm living for this too. I've known that Emily Grover logs into her mom's account to access grades and test scores since freshman year when we became friends, one teenager whose name was redacted wrote in bubbly handwriting. She has looked up my student ID before in order to tell me what I got on my FST and ACT. She looks up all our groups of friends' grades and makes comments about how she can find out our test scores all the time. Other high schools reported that Grover did not seem like logging in was a big deal and that she did it to find out how many days like someone was absent or something. Grover's best friend, whose name was also redacted, appeared to be on the defensive. I've heard people, students saying the rumor that a lot of votes were voted super late, the teen wrote. Emily Grover was going around leadership class saying, I rigged senior superlatives or I'm trying. I'm confused about where any of this is coming from. I definitely have not. Uh-oh. Also, ain't even gonna hold y'all. Loose lips sink ships. Loose lips sink ships. Don't nobody know your business unless you're telling your business. Loose lips sink ships. If you wanna do crime, shut the fuck up about it. Still, none of them reported having direct knowledge about Grover allegedly rigging the election. And one girl told investigators Grover seemed genuinely confused about how it could have happened. Emily and I were sitting at a table with her mom when all of this happened. And Emily said, it would be my luck if someone hacked the system and voted for me and got me disqualified when I have nothing to do with it, said the teen who did Grover's hair and makeup before the ceremony. Whenever I got to Emily's house, she was having a freak out, saying she thought that maybe somebody had done it for her, she added later in the deposition. By that point, rumors had begun swirling around campus and had gotten back to Grover after Gray called students asking about the false votes. But the teacher, who disagreed with the superintendent's decision to crown Grover homecoming queen, hadn't spoken to the teen directly that day, according to her deposition. Instead of simply turning the evidence over to school administrators, Marsh called the police. He handed the case over to Florida Department of Law Enforcement, whose computer crimes unit often probes serious identity theft and internet fraud violations. Special Agent Stephanie Cassidy soon found that a total of 124 votes had come from the same IP address, Carroll's cell phone, between 8 p.m. and 2 a.m., October 29th and October 30th, 2020, according to investigators. A second IP address where at least 122 more votes had been cast was allegedly linked to a computer at Carroll's home. But by the time Cassidy showed up on Carroll's doorstep, she had lawyered up. Any questions could go straight to her attorney, she told the cop. In December, as the school board weighed whether to expel Grover, the teen sent a holiday reindeer trinket and letter to the district's new superintendent, Timothy Smith. In it, she allegedly apologized for looking at other students' accounts, but stopped short of admitting to rigging the homecoming election, according to court documents. In the following week, several teachers, mentors, and coaches vouched for Grover to the board. One tennis coach testified that she was an all-around good kid who was personable, likable, funny, athletic, a team player, and honest, and even tutored his child according to school district documents from January. He considers Emily, to be one of the top 10 kids of all the different hundreds of kids he's coached throughout the years. The teen's attention deficit disorder also came up, with one counselor expressing concern that the alleged hack may be linked to impulsivity caused by her disability. One component of ADD is an inability to appreciate the consequences of certain behavior, the counselor said. Several teachers also stood up for Grover, saying she's a very hard worker who gets along well with others and has never acted violent or disruptive or disobedient. But the board ultimately kicked her out of the school, writing that Emily appears remorseful and is clearly a very bright student, but she caused a major disruption. Her behavior was not a manifestation of her disability, the district found, because it wasn't. And as an ADHD, ADD person, I can honestly say, I've done some crazy shit. I've done some things in my time. And I've done some impulsive things in my time. But let's keep it 100. She thought this through enough. She just didn't think it through all the way. She did the shit. And she wasn't savvy enough to just be like, oh yeah, I go in to check kids' grades, absences, kids ask me to check their information so that I can give them information with college. Like, it's a lot of shit the mom could have said to play it off and be slick. And her daughter having her account, she could have easily said, yeah, I look up my stuff or my kids, you know, or she could act like she didn't know, whatever. But still, sis, y'all should took the no jail plea deal, but you didn't. So here we are. Anyway. Carol was later fired from her job as assistant principal. Asked about the decision, Smith said local parents' fears about computer security played a role. The piece that rattled a lot of people was whether our system and all the private data we have was safe from an accessibility perspective. Could anybody go do this? Smith said in a deposition. And so that was part of what we were communicating, is that our software is safe. The program is tight, which you can easily go to whoever the owner of the software is and have, you know, the application updated to, you know, take away certain access or privileges. Really go to the administrator and have them take away certain accesses and privileges so that where once people were able to see things and, you know, go in and make changes, they can't now. Maybe they can only have read access. And yeah, it logs when you have the system, there's a log of when you log in and what modules you go visit. So, oh my Lord. If they really wanted to get down to the, whatever, let me shut up. Because this is silly for me. But I'm saying it from a perspective of someone who knows something about IT a little bit. A little bit, enough to be dangerous. Enough to know not to do this shit. Jesus Christ, girl, you did this shit because you wanted to. And I just need white people to stand in their shit. But let's continue. I had some parents who, I had one parent in particular who wanted to know if their kids' data had been seen and was concerned about that. He said it was trying to control the fear of not control, but rest people assured. Baby, ain't that in there but they motherfucking grades and their date of birth and their name and address. What data? Your children do not have credit histories and credit profiles in there and shit that's going to stop them from. What data? What information? Oh my gosh, y'all, please. But okay, I get it. I get it. I'm not gonna dismiss these parents' concerns. But I can imagine the parents calling and then teachers like, why the fuck are these parents? And you know, parents are assholes. So you know, they was up in there being assholes about the whole situation. And what about my child? And what about me? And what about me? And it's like, what about you? Smith claimed students were upset by the alleged rigged election too. I think for one, high school traditions, culture, and so forth were damaged. I think that had a negative impact on kids because that's a special time for seniors, he said. I would just say the dignity of it was damaged. I think kids felt, I don't know, disappointed or betrayed. The school district declined to speak about the case and the FDLE didn't respond to questions, but Scott Augenbaum, a former FBI cybercrimes investigator, said parents' fears were not unfounded. To me, it's a legitimate concern. See, that's why I had to shut up. Identity theft is one of the largest growing problems in the U.S. with 11 million thefts a year. Someone could have gotten access to all of those students' information. Still, he said, it's unusual that a small town case like this would make it all the way to trial. Is it political? Maybe, he said. Does someone have an axe to grind? Maybe. Carolyn Grover's strong-willed, reputation-focused refusal to talk to cops and take a no-jail plea agreement also played a role in why things escalated. They expected us to say, yeah, we did it, but we didn't, Carol said. I would excuse me, I wouldn't let them talk to my daughter. We just didn't answer their questions the way they wanted us to. Midway through the investigation, Etheridge asked Special Agent Cassidy for the courtesy of notifying him if a warrant was issued in the pair's arrest so they could turn themselves in according to court documents. Instead, the FDLE sent multiple cop cars to mom and daughter's home within minutes of getting the warrant, according to Etheridge and court documents. It was like killing a fly with a hammer, Etheridge said. Police acted like they were freaking Al Capone. Well, I mean, they hacked something. They committed crime, baby. They did crime, girl. So they treated them like they did crime. Mm-hmm. Cops then put out a press release within hours of the arrest declaring FDLE arrests mother and daughter for unauthorized access into hundreds of students' accounts, which sounds accurate to me, but okay. It detailed how they were hit with 3 felony charges and 1 misdemeanor, including criminal use of personally identifiable information and unlawful use of a 2-way communication device. The press release sparked a firestorm of local and national media coverage, along with disdain for Grover and Carol. As a mother of a Tate graduate, one that is an upcoming senior and another an incoming freshman, I'm livid that Carol gave her snot-nosed brat of a daughter access to my child's records, one mom fumed in the comment section, which covered the story. I feel as violated as I would if she worked in the medical field and violated HIPAA. Oh, you HIPAA's got y'all hoes in a choke. Oh, y'all love HIPAA. Oh my God. Another local told me a lot of people around Carol can't stand her now. Tate High is more of a rural school. Rural's got me in a chokehold. It's too many R's. With that small town attitude. 2 days after the arrest, homecoming queen runner-up Ariana Wyatt spoke to Good Morning America about the scandal. Oh, bitch, you made it to Good Morning America? Wow. White people love drama. The other girl that could have won, that wanted it, that could have been one of the runners-up. I feel bad for them because that was an opportunity that they lost. But she ended up on Good Morning America. Y'all, calm down. Wyatt and second runner-up Kendall Blackman didn't return requests for comment. Reached by phone, Blackman's sister Kaylee snapped, "It's in her past. She doesn't want to talk about it." I know that's right. Because either way, she still would have been runner-up. And did she get to go to Good Morning America? No. So of course she doesn't want to talk about the shit. Fuck all y'all. Okay. Etheridge's defense so far hinges on a tech forensic expert who found that the 124 votes linked to Carol's cell phone were actually cast in a 20-minute time period. That's not humanly possible, he said, adding it might be a sign a computer program was used or that a tech glitch occurred. Etheridge, who took the case pro bono as a favor to Grover's dad, calls the duo my girls and Carol Mama Bear in a silky Southern accent. Though he initially encouraged them to take a no jail plea agreement, he's skeptical because nobody can point to a human at election runner who can verify the false votes, he said. Nobody knows where these yo-yos come from. There's not one human being that can say definitively that it came from this IP address. He also disputes the 8 p.m. to 2 a.m. timeline laid out by investigators, in part because the app has generated reports based on multiple time zones, according to court documents. Etheridge said Carol may have been jogging without her cell phone at the time of the alleged hack and that Grover was spending the night at a buddy's house. Neither he nor the woman, however, have a theory about who may have cast the vote or how the ordeal unfolded, they told me. Ultimately, Etheridge believes officials blew the case out of proportion considering it's a nonviolent crime with no named victims. The school board pushed this as the absolute crime of the century, he said. They pushed it to the limit. There's no evidence that any students' grades were changed or that personal information was stolen, according to court documents. Even so, Etheridge said he urged Grover and Carol to take a no jail plea agreement, the terms of which are unclear. But Carol continues to insist it wasn't much of a deal. They're saying, by God, we didn't do it, Etheridge said. So we're going to trial against my advice. Since the arrest, Carol said she's become the Hester Prynne of the Florida Panhandle. Bitch. Did she invoke the crucible? Y'all better be glad that I am well-versed and well-rounded so that I can catch all these Caucasian all these Caucasian jokes for y'all and point them out, because my God, this is comedy. Oh my God, this is comedy. Hester Prynne of the Florida Pen, bitch. They want to burn her at the stake, y'all. Hester Prynne of the Florida Panhandle. I'm sorry, y'all. Woo! Condemned by, was Hester Prynne, was that the Scarlet Letter or the Crucible? The Scarlet Letter. Hester Prynne was the Scarlet Letter. Ah! Okay, I got my white people mixed up. But y'all get the gist, y'all. Y'all get the gist. I am screaming right now. This is so entertaining. Ain't they were repeatedly told, take the no jail plea deal. Just I'm pretty sure they probably wouldn't even have got misdemeanors. They could have gotten their records expunged, I'm sure, but oh my God. Since the arrest, Carol said she's become the Hester Prynne of the Florida Panhandle, condemned by a town rife with moral panic. I don't really even leave the house anymore, she said. I can count on one hand the number of people who have stood by me through this. Seeing her own unflattering mugshot splash across TV screens has been hard to stomach. It's awful. Every time I see it, I cringe, she said, adding everyone seems to have an opinion about her, her daughter, and the case. So many people said she'll let the kid take the rap or the kid will get off. Everybody's got their predictions, Carol said, calling it hurtful. I don't know why I care so much about people who don't know me. It doesn't matter. They all already think we're guilty. But she added, the truth will rise. I think it will. Grover has had a more difficult time. After she was taken into custody in March, police arrested her again and charged her as an adult. She was forbidden from graduating with her class. She has lost more than 20 pounds and is seeing a psychiatrist for trauma triggered by incidents with the cops, along with other issues, she said. In the 2021 Tate High School yearbook, students photoshopped a horse's ass over Grover's face, causing the book to be recalled in May. According to Carol and local reports, it was awful. She's dealing with the scorn of her peers in every venue, Carol said. She went from being everybody's friend to having no friends. Teenagers have harassed her on social media and via text, including with a cruel group message mocking her mugshot, she said. In August, less than a week before Grover's freshman year was set to begin at the University of Western Florida, she received a letter saying she was no longer welcome. Aww. The school alleged that Grover failed to disclose that she'd been charged with a crime, according to Carol. She's 18 years old, and this affects her earning potential and her image, said Carol, adding she's since hired a private investigator to dig up information before trial. There are so many layers to this case. It's so warped and twisted. Grover, for her part, just wants life to go back to normal. I want the truth to come out, for people to like me again, to be able to go to school and to just be happy, she said. More than a year after the alleged hack, the mom and daughter insist that even after the false votes were deleted, Grover still won the majority. And court documents appear to back up that claim. Oh, so she did win. Oh, and the school district never officially stripped Grover of the crown, she said. People said it got revoked, but that never happened. The teen still keeps the gleaming headwear tucked away inside her mom's brick house. Last month, a new homecoming queen was named at Tate High School. Like Grover, the young woman, Darby Phillips, had blonde hair and a smile as she clutched a bouquet of red roses during the ceremony. Something was missing, though. Tradition has it, last year's homecoming queen returns to pass off the crown to the new winner. But this year, the custom was scrapped for one big reason, Grover said. They didn't ask me back. Wow. Y'all, I'm sorry, but that was absolutely tragic. Absolutely tragic. So we are getting into another story that I am ready to get into because I've been fuming about this whole incident. If you listen to last week's episode called, what was it? Honestly, with Mocha Minute, then you will hear me mention this story. But we have to talk about this. We need to talk about this, and we need to talk about this in a comprehensive manner. Because I believe that there needs to be a lot of consequences and repercussions for this, a lot. And I mean that, like, a lot. Okay. So a man, 61, convicted of raping the Lovely Bones author Alice Siebold in 1981, after she'd ID'd him in court, is exonerated after producers of Netflix movie based on her memoir, Lucky, hired a PI because he doubted the story.
So let's get into this. If you are familiar with the story, The Lovely Bones, which became a movie, the woman who was the author of the book alleges that she was raped in 1981 and that she was raped by a Black man. And he was convicted and went to jail for it. Later on, she wrote a book about it, the rape and the incident and what happened, and Netflix picked it up to make a movie about it. During that time, this is what unfolds when a producer of the movie gets a hold of the story and starts working with the author directly to produce the film. A man who was convicted of raping award-winning author Alice Siebold 40 years ago has been exonerated after a producer working on a Netflix adaptation of the writer's memoir noticed inconsistencies in the story, hired a private investigator to look into it, and sent the case back to court. Anthony Broadwater spent 16 years behind bars for the 1981 rape that was the center point of Siebold's 1999 memoir, Lucky, the book that launched her career. She wrote in the memoir how she was raped in a tunnel by a Black man when she was a 19-year-old first-year student at Syracuse University in 1981. The book sold over 1 million copies. Broadwater was convicted in 1982 after Siebold, now 59, identified him as her rapist in court. She had walked past him in the street months after the attack, then told police that was her rapist, but she didn't know his name. It was only when a cop gave Broadwater's name, because he had been in the area at the time, that he was roped into the investigation. In a police lineup, she picked the man standing next to him, but Broadwater was still tried, and in court, Siebold did pick him. The other piece of evidence that convinced him was hair analysis, but the technique used has long been considered unreliable by the Department of Justice. Mind you, this was like in 1981, so I don't even think they found a hair fiber, but they probably didn't do any DNA testing on it because I don't think we had the technology or capability back then. So you look at a hair fiber, like, oh, it's a hair fiber. It looks like his hair. You do it by, you put it under the microscope and look at it, and that was how they used to do hair analysis back in the day. Under a microscope. But now, of course, with DNA evidence, we can just extract the DNA from it and do testing and matching. But you can imagine how, yes, based on this information, this man was locked up and did 16 years. Broadwater was released from prison in 1999, the year the book came out. He lived a quiet life afterwards, working as a trash hauler and marrying, but refusing to have children because he didn't want them to have to live with the stigma of his rape conviction. He said he was treated as a pariah because he was on the sex offenders registry. Siebold's career in the meantime soared. In 2002, she published The Lovely Bones, another story based around child kidnap and rape. It sold over 5 million copies in America alone, grossing 60 million in sales. And it was turned into a blockbuster Hollywood movie in 2009, starring Charles Ronan, Stanley Tucci, and Mark Wahlberg. Let's see. So they're going, let me find out where, okay. So Alice Siebold was writing her hugely successful novel, The Lovely Bones, about the rape and murder of a teenage girl in the late 1990s when she found herself having to abandon that project so she could complete her own memoir about how she was raped as a student. She said years later that she wanted the dead narrator of her novel, Susie Salmon, to tell her own story while her memoir, Lucky, would be the real deal about rape. That memoir was published in 1999, 3 years before her novel, and received great critical acclaim. But it would be The Lovely Bones that would launch her into literary stardom after it became an instant classic. The novel starts with the arresting line, "My name is Salmon, like the fish, first name Susie. I was 14 when I was murdered on December 6, 1973. The book is told in the voice of Susie, a dead girl speaking from heaven after she has been raped and murdered. Susie tells the harrowing tale of her vicious abduction and murder in a cornfield near her home and observes the events which follow. How her dismembered elbow is discovered in the field is in a patch of blood, but her body is nowhere to be found. This allows her parents to harbor a vain hope that she would be found alive. The betrayal of her family, suffering the immense grief of loss her, of their child was what made the novel a hit with critics. The New York Times, Miko Kakutani, described it as a deeply affecting meditation on the way in which terrible pain and loss can be redeemed. But others found Susie's ability to flit between heaven and earth an unconvincing plot device. The ghost of the girl is glimpsed by family members as they walk around corners in the house. And she even enters the body of a school friend who is making love to her own former sweetheart. The novel was immensely popular because, particularly with teenage girls and women. English author Joan Smith attacked the novel's apple pie sentimentality, saying it was sickly sweet. Literary critic, Philip Hensher described the book as a slick, overpoweringly saccharine and unfeeling exercise in sentiment. The novel went on to win the American Booksellers Association Book of the Year Award for Adult Fiction in 2003 and was made into a movie by fantasy-loving director Peter Jackson, starring Saoirse Ronan, Susan Sarandon, and Stanley Tucci. The Lovely Bones has influenced an entire subgenre of young adult fiction known derisively as sick lit, which has enduring popularity to this day. Commonly, it is fiction which revolves around the afterlife, where protagonists are killed early on in the narrative, finding themselves in a strange ghost world. The hugely successful Twilight Saga, a series of fantasy romance novels by Stephanie Meyer, was influenced by Siebold's book. Tim Musianti, a scriptwriter who had signed on to the project, noticed inconsistencies with her story and hired a private investigator. It's not exactly clear what happened next, but it led to the case returning to court in New York on Monday and to Onondaga County DA William Fitzpatrick admitting this should have never happened. So there was also a piece in it. When Netflix was making the movie, there was also an issue where they had hired a well-known Black actor to play the rapist in the film. And the Black actor thought that people would feel some type of way if he played this role and backed out of it. So the producers at Netflix decided to make the rapist in the story a white man. And the author became upset because Netflix was like, well, we don't feel comfortable putting out really this story, given this climate. Good on you, Netflix. Good the fuck on you. Because now y'all going to have to make this story, and now y'all going to have to tell what the fuck. Netflix, you got a story for real now. So anywho, Broadwater broke down in tears as the conviction was expunged. He is now asking for an apology from Siebold, who has yet to comment. And she did give an apology. And I'm not going to read her apology because it's not enough. It wasn't even an apology. Like, I'm sorry that happened to him. I'm so glad that, you know, this wrong was righted. But bitch, seriously, I just hope and pray that maybe Miss Siebold will come forward and say, hey, I made a grave mistake, and give me an apology. I sympathize with her, but she was wrong. I started poking around and trying to figure out what really happened here, Musianti told the Associated Press earlier this week. Siebold wrote in Lucky of being raped as a first year student at Syracuse in May 1981. This is what I remember. My lips were cut. I bit down on them when he grabbed me from behind and covered my mouth. He said these words, "I'll kill you if you scream." I remained motionless. "Do you understand? If you scream, you're dead." I nodded my head. My arms were pinned to my sides by his right arm wrapped around me, and my mouth was covered with his left. She goes on to describe the rape in graphic detail, how she had to talk to the rapist to encourage him, tell him he was a good man, and how she wished it to be over. She wrote how he then apologized in tears once the attack was over and told her she was a good girl. Siebold described running back to her dorm, confiding in her friends that she was just beaten and raped in the park. "My face smashed in, cuts across my nose and lip, a tear along my cheek. My hair was matted with leaves. My clothes were inside out and bloody. My eyes were glazed," she said. Months later, she said she spotted a Black man in the street and thought it was him. "He was smiling as he approached. He recognized me. It was a stroll in the park to him. He had met an acquaintance on the street," wrote Siebold. "Hey, girl," he said, "don't I know you from somewhere?" She said she didn't respond. "I looked directly at him, knew his face had been the face over me in the tunnel." Siebold went to police. but she didn't know the man's name, and initial sweep of the area failed to locate him. An officer suggested the man in the street must have been Broadwater, who had supposedly been seen in the area. Siebold gave Broadwater the pseudonym Gregory Madison in her book. After Broadwater was arrested, though, Siebold failed to identify him in a police lineup, picking a different man as her attacker because the expression in his eyes told me that if we were alone, if there were no wall between us, he would call me by name and then kill me. Siebold writes in her memoir that Broadwater and the man next to him looked similar and that moments after she made her choice, it dawned on her that she had picked the wrong man. She later identified Broadwater in court. He was convicted in 1982 based largely on her identification of him and because of evidence provided by an expert in microscopic hair analysis that had tied Broadwater to the crime. That type of analysis has since been deemed junk science by the Department of Justice. Sprinkle some junk science onto a faulty identification and it's the perfect recipe for a wrongful conviction, Broadwater's attorney David Hammond told the Post Standard. In their motion to vacate the conviction, the defense attorneys Hammond and Schwartz argued that the case relied solely on Siebold's identification of Broadwater in the courtroom and now a discredited method of hair analysis. Told y'all they put it under a microscope because, they also said that prosecutorial misconduct was a factor during the police lineup because a lawyer had falsely claimed to Siebold that Broadwater and the man sitting next to him were friends who looked alike and had purposely appeared together to trick her. The attorney said this false claim had tainted Siebold's later testimony. Muscianti hired a private investigator earlier this year who put him in touch with J. David Hammond of Syracuse-based CDH Law, who brought in fellow defense lawyer Melissa Schwartz of Cambrary and Brennick. Hammond and Schwartz credited Fitzpatrick for taking a personal interest in the case and understanding that scientific advances have cast doubt on the use of hair analysis, the only type of forensic evidence that was produced at Broadwater's trial to link him to Siebold's rape. The fate of the film adaptation of Lucky was unclear in light of Broadwater's exoneration. A message-seeking comment was left with its new executive producer, Jonathan Bronfman of Toronto-based Joe Bro Productions. Messages to Siebold seeking comment were sent through her publisher and her literary agency. Broadwater remained in New York Sex Offenders Registry after finishing his prison term in 1999. Broadwater, who has worked as a trash hauler and a handyman in the years since his release from prison, told the AP that the rape conviction blighted his job prospects and his relationships with friends and his family members. Even after he married a woman who believed in his innocence, Broadwater never wanted to have children. We had a big argument sometimes about kids, and I told her I could never, ever allow kids to come into this world with a stigma on my back, he said. Broadwater was a pariah because he remained on the sex offenders list. On my two hands, I can count the people that allowed me to grace their homes and dinners, and I don't get past 10. That's very traumatic to me. Siebold wrote in Lucky that when she was informed that she picked someone other than the man she previously identified as her rapist, she said the two men looked almost identical. She wrote that she realized the defense would be that a panicked white girl saw a black man on the street. She wrote familiarly to her, and in her mind, she connected this to her rape. She was accusing the wrong man. Broadwater described how his life was destroyed by the false conviction. He had just returned home to Syracuse in 1981 after age 20, after serving in the Marine Corps in California. He had gone home because his father was ill, he said. His father helped worth him during the trial, and he died shortly after Broadwater was sent to prison. Damn. Siebold spotted him in the street 5 months after her attack and said he could be her attacker, and he was arrested. Siebold reported her attack immediately, and evidence was collected from a rape kit. She described her attacker to police, but the resulting composite sketch did not resemble him. Siebold did not identify him in a lineup, but later said she was confused. Siebold said she pointed out a different man as her attacker because the expression in his eyes told me that if we were alone, he would kill me. Broadwater broke down in tears, and I never, ever thought I would see the day that I would be exonerated. The district attorney apologized to Broadwater privately after the court hearing. When he spoke to me about the wrong that was done to me, I couldn't help but cry. The relief that a district attorney of that magnitude would side with me in this case is so profound. I don't know what to say. I'm so elated. The cold can't even keep me cold.
Wow. So here's the deal. This woman owes that man every cent she earned from every book she's ever sold. Period. And every royalty and penny thereafter belongs to that man, because she cannot replace what she took from him. This man found a wife who believed in his innocence and wanted to have children with him. And he refused because he didn't want to raise kids whose daddy was on a sex offenders registry. Do you hear that, Nicki Minaj? Jesus Christ. Y'all, when I heard that story, I've been over it. I've been livid ever since I heard it, and I am done. Like, you know, white women do stuff like this to Black men, and Black men have all this smoke for Black women. I'm going to leave that alone. I'm going to put that to rest. I'm going to leave that right there. Because I'm moving on to the next story, which is even more ridiculous. Y'all, we broke Dave Chappelle. We broke this nigga. He's broken. We broke Dave. This nigga is still in his feelings. So Dave, if you're not familiar, Dave Chappelle is a Washington, D.C. native who went to the Duke Ellington School of the Arts, which is a prominent performing arts high school in the District of Columbia. It's one of the most prominent performing high schools in the country. I guess you could say Duke Ellington is D.C.'s Juilliard. That's the best way that I could describe it. You have to audition in order to get in. It is rigorous, and don't just anybody get into Duke Ellington. So a lot of Broadway and theater performers and artists came from that school. A lot of DC talent came from that school. So it's a great school, but Dave decided to attend the school because the school is going to name an auditorium after him. Now, as a parent of a performing arts high school student, let me tell you something. If you're in performing arts high school, if you're in performing arts period, you know LGBTQIA people. Ain't no two ways about it. Ain't no two ways about it. If you go to performing arts high school, oh, you're going to run into some queer kids. You're going to run into queer kids, and it just is what it is. So Dave, you know, they were going to name the auditorium after him. And so the kids were like, no, don't name it after him because we don't like him. We don't like what he's doing. We don't like his material. We don't want this auditorium named after him. So Dave comes to the school. This grown-ass man went to the high school to address these children. Y'all listen to this shit, because, oh, bless his heart. A student who attended Dave Chappelle's recent appearance at the comedian's former high school said it was a grotesque display of ego and narcissism. And let me tell y'all something, narcissism got all y'all in a chokehold. But I do believe a lot of people are narcissistic. Like, it's like a common trait right now, because the more and more that being socially detached and, you know, the games we play, especially with dating, I think we're breeding narcissists, more and more narcissists into the culture, culturally speaking. But people use it a lot, though, and it's taking a beating. I'm just going to put that out there. Multiple media outlets reported that Chappelle made a surprise visit to his alma mater, the Duke Ellington School of the Arts in Washington, D.C., on Tuesday to speak with students before Thanksgiving. The school had initially postponed plans for the comedian to appear at a school fundraiser after students threatened to organize a walkout over comments Chappelle made about trans people in his recent Netflix comedy special, The Closer. But Allison Finch Wilson, whose 16-year-old son, Andrew Wilson, attends Duke Ellington, said the parents of the students at the school received an email Tuesday afternoon informing them that there would be a special assembly so kids would get let out 30 minutes later than normal. Andrew told Insider that students were instructed to place their cell phones in pouches as they approached the assembly hall.
Shortly after, Chappelle came out on stage and asked any student who were offended by him to raise their hands and approach the stage to voice their grievances. No, he didn't. Two transgender people were in line, and one transgender person was trying to explain, and Dave Chappelle kept talking over him and blatantly disrespecting the fact that he was talking and trying to make a joke out of the situation, Andrew told Insider. And then the second transgender person tried to explain to Dave Chappelle what misgendering was, and Dave Chappelle interrupted her and completely ignored that, he added, and then moved on to the next person. Misgendering is the act of referring to a person with a gender that does not match their gender identity. Andrew added that at the end of the evening, Chappelle proceeded to tell students, I am better what I do than all of you in this room combined. He added, it was just a grotesque display of ego and narcissism. Yeah, he told them, like, pretty much, I'm rich and y'all not, and fuck y'all. And the thing about, I'm mad, because normally these students, the one time y'all actually obey and put y'all cell phones away, y'all are supposed to record this so people could show him acting an ass. Y'all kids, I swear. Andrew later said that throughout the event, Chappelle, who appeared on stage with film cameras for a documentary, was reluctant to engage with the concerns of the students, but continually told the audience that they can't silence him. He kept on saying, you can't silence me. How dare you try to silence me? Not one person in the room was trying to silence him at all, Andrew said. One girl raised her hand and said, I understand what you're saying, and I respect your art, but you don't understand how many transgender people die every day, he said. Andrew added that Chappelle then interrupted the girl and said, people die every day using the N-word instead of people. Oh, we're going to tell the niggas die every day. Also, a lot of those trans people they're talking about that die every day are Black. Boy, this nigga, ooh, he don't get it. Representatives for Chappelle did not immediately respond to Insider's request for comment, but Carla Sims, a spokesperson for Chappelle, provided a statement to the news site Political, which initially reported that Chappelle had visited the school. He said, these kids deserve an F for forgiveness, Sims said of Chappelle's response to the evening. Give them some space to grow. They are going to say things that are immature. Andrew, who identifies as gay, said, Chappelle's appearance was the most narcissistic display I have ever seen in my entire life because of the comedian's attitude and ego. You could just tell that he didn't take that situation seriously and how he didn't want to be there. That was definitely very clear in his action throughout the entire night. The event ended, he said, with the school's principal coming out on stage with Chappelle, and they hugged and laughed. He added, and then he brought Erykah Badu out. Bitch. Then he brought Erykah Badu out. I'm screaming. Oh my God, y'all. These niggas is musty. A lot of these older Gen X niggas are fucking musty. And it's sad. Oh, Lord. Andrew's mother, who was also a Duke Ellington alumnus, added that the goal had never been to cancel culture Chappelle, whom she said has been a tremendous benefactor to the school, but to facilitate an environment where the students can engage with Chappelle without such a wild power dynamic. Chappelle has been a prominent supporter of Duke Ellington School of the Arts over the years, donating a total of $100,000 and giving the school one of his Emmy Awards, according to Deadline. Chappelle also held a master class for students in 2017 that featured fellow Bradley Cooper and Chris Tucker. The outcry over The Closer, the sixth stand-up special Chappelle has had on Netflix, has been widespread. In the special, Chappelle voiced support for the Harry Potter author, J.K. Rowling, who has criticized for anti-trans comments during a monologue. Chappelle also said that gender is a fact, and every human being in this room, every human being on Earth has to pass through the legs of a woman to be on Earth, which is extremely transphobic. Because I had a cesarean, so you telling me that I'm not a woman because I had a C-section? Bitch, shut the fuck up. Anyway, he went there and spoke to those kids, and it was very condescending to them. He didn't listen to them. He talked down to them, and now the principal said that they're going to move forward and name the theater after him anyway. But I think those children should vandalize it every chance that they get. paint a big dick over it. And I think his behavior is really, really asshole-y. He's starting to act like a white man, and it's really starting to irk me. He acts like a white man, and it's starting to irk the fuck out of me. And it says something, because he hangs out with Joe Rogan, and I don't know. So let me pick my next story. Y'all, I demand compensation. I'm about to file a lawsuit to petition the court to compensate me in every way possible because I demand it. A woman who sued mom's doctor claiming she never should have been born wins millions. A star show jumper who sued her mom's doctor claiming she should have never been born has won the right to millions in damages. Evie Toombs launched the landmark wrongful conception case against the general practitioner as she suffers from spina bifida and sometimes spends 24 hours a day connected to tubes. The 20-year-old wrongful conception claim saw her take Dr. Philip Mitchell to court over his failure to advise her mother to take vital supplements before getting pregnant. She alleged that the medic told her mom, Caroline, that she needed to take folic acid to minimize risk of spina bifida affecting her baby. She would have put off conception. This in turn would have meant Evie would never have been born at all. And in a unique ruling at London's High Court today, Judge Rosalind Coe, QC, backed Evie's case and awarded her the right to a huge compensation payout. Her lawyers earlier said that the amount Evie is claiming has not yet been calculated, but confirmed that it would be big since it would cover the cost of her extensive care needs for life. Evie, who has forged a career in show jumping, competing against both disabled and able-bodied riders, has sued for wrongful conception for having been born in a damaged state. Her barrister, Susan Rodway QC, told the court, "I too need a barrister." The judge found that Mitchell had not told Caroline of Skegness, Lincolnshire, of the importance of taking folic acid supplements before getting pregnant. And if she had been told, she would have delayed conceiving and instead had a different, totally healthy baby, the judge added, which is true. You have to take folic acid because that does help healthy spinal cord nervous system development in your baby. Folic acid is very important. During the trial, last month, the court heard that 50-year-old Caroline, who was also a keen horsewoman, had gone to see Mitchell at the Hawthorne practice to discuss her plans to have a baby in February 2001. This was a very precious decision to start a family because she herself had lost her parents when she was young. They had been refraining from sexual intercourse until after they had received advice at this consultation. But despite discussing folic acid during the appointment, Caroline claimed she was not told by Mitchell's of its importance in spina bifida prevention. She told the judge that the doctor had told her to go home and have lots of sex, which she found somewhat blunt. "He told me it was not necessary," she said. "I was advised that if I had a good diet previously, I would not have to take folic acid." Rodway said that had Caroline been properly advised by Mitchell, she would not have gone on to conceive as quickly as she did. She would have paused her pregnancy plans, started a course of folic acid treatment, then attempted to conceive, she claims. It is her evidence she would have read up on it and wouldn't have attempted to become pregnant until she was satisfied that she had protected herself as much as possible, she said. If she had indeed put off getting pregnant, she would have had a normal, healthy baby, but one who was a genetically different person from Evie, the QC added. Evie was diagnosed with a lympholimmicocele, LMM, a form of neurotubal defect to the spine leading to permanent disability after her birth in November 2001. Her mobility is said to be very limited, and she will depend more and more on a wheelchair as she grows older. While she also suffers from bowel and bladder issues, the court heard. She has previously spoken about her issues on the ITV show Hidden Disabilities, What's the Truth? Because, if you see her now, she's upright.
And at first, guess you wouldn't expect her to have spina bifida when we see the typical symptoms, which means a bent over severely curved spine. So for her, yeah, you can't tell. But she does have the diagnosis, and they're saying it's going to progress more and more as she gets older when she will need to rely on a wheelchair, in addition to her having bladder and bowel issues. Poor baby. So she is hooked up to a lot of tubes regularly. Poor baby. Michael Navarro, representing the doctor, denied liability, suggesting that Caroline might already have been pregnant when she went to see Mitchell. I don't know what that's supposed to mean, babe. He told the judge that Mitchell claimed to have given reasonable advice about the desirability of folic acid supplements being taken. It was his usual practice to tell prospective parents that 400 micrograms should be taken by those preparing for pregnancy and all through their first trimester. He said he would have told the mother that if she had a good diet and thus folic acid levels anyway, supplements may be less important, but denied saying they were not necessary. However, today, Cole ruled against the doctor. In the circumstances, I find that Mrs. Toombs was not pregnant at the time of the consultation with Dr. Mitchell, she said in her judgment. She was not advised in accordance with the guidance to take folic acid prior to conception and for the first 12 weeks of pregnancy. She was not advised about the relationship between folic acid supplementation and the prevention of spina bifida neural tube of defects. Had she been provided with the correct recommended advice, she would have delayed attempts to conceive. In the circumstances, there would have been a later conception, which would have resulted in a normal, healthy baby. I therefore find that the claimant's claim succeeds on liability. The case will return to court to decide the full amount of Evie's compensation unless agreed by the parties outside of the court. According to her own website, Evie describes her motto in life as find a way, not an excuse. Bitch, she said find a way to the bag, not an excuse, okay? Be like Evie for president. I feel her. As well as competing in show jumping nationally and internationally, she educates children about invisible illnesses and works at Nottingham University. She writes, I was born with a form of spina bifida, but having a passion in life gives me purpose and direction. In 2018, she met Prince Harry and Meghan Markle when she won the Inspiration Young Person at a Well Child charity event. Y'all, so here's the deal. I, too, was inconvenienced at birth and did not ask to be here. I did not ask to be born under the stigma of anti-Blackness. I did not ask to be born into this oppressive system. And I feel I am due compensation. I'm due compensation. It has affected me in a myriad of ways. It has caused me undue stress. It has caused me undue trauma. It has caused me PTSD. I am traumatized every time I see a police officer. I literally jump out of my skin. I'm traumatized when I see white people. I'm in fear for my life. It's traumatizing. It's scary. And we didn't ask to be here. So we are due compensation. Okay. Find a way. Not an excuse, America. You got it. You need to turn the money over. Okay. Black people, find a way. Not an excuse. You are owed reparations, okay? So if you don't think you are owed reparations, don't take that shit. But politely shut the fuck up for the rest of us who are owed, okay? All right. Now, y'all, taking it home. We taking it home because, baby, Jussie Smollett is on trial, y'all, for... okay, I'm sorry, y'all. This Jussie Smollett trial is so stunt queen. He is a stunt queen. Y'all, okay. I was on the fence. Like, I didn't want to believe that Jussie was capable of doing something like this. But the more and more they talk about this, the more and more I have questions. I got questions and I want answers. I have questions. I have questions and I want answers. But y'all hit me up and let me know if y'all think Jussie did it or not. Because for real, I'm going back and forth. I'm waiting for the smoking gun to appear as far as evidence and information. Like I'm waiting for a smoking gun, like a definitive this is what happened, like boom, boom, boom. But right now is he said, she said, it's his word against his word. But the mess, y'all, it's so much mess is unfolding. Now, Jesse could have made all of this go away if he just admitted his guilt and paid $150,000. Jesse could have made all of this go away if he had just admitted his guilt and paid $150,000. And if he laid low long enough, we could have moved on past this because, I mean, this is like, to me, I feel like it's a victimless crime. Because, you know, like, really, no harm, no foul. Just pay the $150 for the resources and time they use trying to find somebody who hurt your ass and just let like, just brush it all away. Like, I mean, with the right project, Jesse could have really put this behind him, but he didn't. He's going to try. He's going to court. So y'all, I'm breaking it down. We have ground to cover here, but y'all got to hear this shit. Y'all, we got to keep up with this because, oh my God. I'm so entertained. And I don't know what that says about me, that I'm entertained. But I don't give a fuck. I'm entertained. As the third day of Jesse Smollett's trial got underway on Wednesday, one of the men that allegedly helped stage the attack against the Empire actor took the stand testifying for the state. Abimbola Bola Asundaro, yeah, get into my accent, yeah, I banged that, y'all know I did, testified that Smollett recruited him and his brother to carry out a staged hate crime attack against the actor back in 2019. Wow, this was like before the pandemic. And they still on your ass about it, Jesse. They gonna make an example out of you for faking a hate crime. Oh, Lord, Jesse. Testifying, and you know they mad because, you know, that police went to jail for Laquan McDonald and shit, and they found out about them Chicago Black sites. And so, yeah, they already pissy about shit. Jesse, you got to calm down. Testifying for hours, Asundaro told the court he met Smollett while working as an extra on the set of Empire. The two became very good friends, and Asundaro called Smollett his brother. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. Smollett was reportedly unhappy after the studio received a letter in the mail targeting him. He didn't like the way the studio handled the threat. Well, what was they supposed to do, Jesse? What did you want them to do? I'm not clear on that part either. Like, what did you want the studio to do? Did you fake that too? Did you fake that threat? Like, everything. I'm questioning everything now, Jesse. Like, what is happening? What is going on with you, babe? Like, you was wilding, son. You was really wilding when you was doing this shit. Anywho, so... the actor then approached the Asundaro brothers, giving them money to buy supplies and telling them what to say during the attack. He asked them to use racial and homophobic slurs to reference the show and MAGA. Asundaro said he wanted me to do the purchases specifically because he trusted me. Asundaro said he agreed to the plan because he felt indebted to Smollett. He said the actor helped him get promoted from an extra to a stand-in role on the show. The other brother is scheduled to testify later in the trial. He also was also recruited on the set of Empire. Smollett was charged last year with 6 counts of disorderly conduct for lying to the police. He denies that the attack was planned. Okay, so we're going on to the second part. So that was all the testimony on the third day of the trial. The brothers are saying they were recruited on the set of Empire where they met Jesse, and he gave them the money to go buy the rope and the tape and the MAGA hat. So, he's still at trial, y'all. It's still going on, and I need to go, after I finish this, I'm gonna go find out what happened today. Jesse Smollett's defense team let out a brutal cross-examination against the prosecutor's star witness on Thursday. The witness claimed the pair were dating, had masturbated together at a gay bathhouse, and the attack was fueled by a desire to be the actor's security guard.
Abimbola Asundaro testified on stand at a Chicago criminal court and was questioned for 2 hours by the actor's attorney, Shay Allen, on day four of the trial. Okay, pick up the pace. Let me get into this. Allen attempted to make Asundaro look like a liar, drug dealer, and opportunist who used his relationship with Smollett to further his career. He is also accused of telling the star he'd make this all go away and not testify if he and his brother Olabinjo were paid $1 million each. You told him if he gave you and your brother $1 million each, you wouldn't testify. Allen asked Asundaro, but his response was no. At the beginning of Allen's cross-examination of the witness, she tried to claim that Smollett and Asundaro had a sexual relationship by suddenly asking when he and the actor started dating, the New York Post reported. We were never dating, said Asundaro across the room. Smollett averted his gaze. On Wednesday, Asundaro told jurors he and Smollett had gone to the Steamworks bathhouse together in Chicago's Boys Town neighborhood, a predominantly gay community, on Thursday. Allen asked if gay pornography was played on the televisions inside the spa. I don't recall, said Asundaro. You don't recall seeing gay pornography? You don't remember masturbating with him? Allen questioned. Asundaro said no. The attorney also asked if Smollett had a crush on him and if he thought sexual tension between them would further his acting career if Asundaro answered back that he didn't know there was sexual tension. Allen then brought up that homosexuality is illegal in Nigeria, where the brothers have connections, and recalled the time Asundaro had called someone on the set of Empire a fat. This was to potentially claim that the hate crime was real and fueled by homophobia, but the prosecution successfully objected to the question. Asundaro and his brother are the focus of the tawdry maelstrom of the prosecution's star witnesses. They had previously claimed to the police that Smollett paid them $3,500 to stage the hate crime. The defense argues that the attack wasn't staged and it was carried out because the brothers are homophobic or hope to scare the actor into hiring Asundaro as his security guard for a $5,000 monthly salary. Smollett now faces 6 felony counts of disorderly conduct for lying to police, and if he is found guilty, faces 3 years in jail. So in that regard, I thought that was really sleazy of Jesse's attorneys to try to use homosexuality as a plot device, if you will, for the defense. The brothers are denying it. They didn't go with him to any bathhouses or have sexual interaction with him. They said they met him on the set of Empire and, you know, they appreciated him because he got them promoted from walk-ons to regular occurring characters. So now, here we go. Homophobia hits snag when photo comes out showing Asundaro brothers shirtless at Pride Parade. So let me tell you what I think. I think that these brothers said, we're not going to jail for you, Jussie. Period. These motherfuckers said, Jussie, we're not going to jail for you. You can do what you like. Just come clean. He don't want to come clean. So it is what it is. But yeah, these niggas was like, oh, you won't play the homophobics? Here you go. Wow. The high profile trial has been hinged on the Empire actor's allegations that one of the Asundaro brothers is homophobic, sparking a brutal attack on him in January of 2019, which allegedly involved the brothers shouting slurs as they bit, kicked, and punched him. The 39-year-old and openly gay Black actor is now facing hefty charges of felony disorderly conduct after Ola and Abel Asundaro claimed Smollett paid them $3,500 to stage the assault in order to raise his profile because he was unhappy with his role on Empire. So that's another thing. The brothers are alleging that Jesse wanted to raise his profile. I guess he figured because he was on Empire and it was a hit show that he would probably be getting like more offers and things. But that's not how that was pretty much going to work out for him, because at the end of the day, I think that was one of his first on-screen roles. He may have done some other minor roles, previously, but yeah, he's going to have to really build himself, you know, by taking on roles and doing projects and putting himself out there. This was stunt queen all the way. Oh boy. Ola has previously denied all accusations that he is homophobic, despite attorneys questioning him about certain offensive language used in his tweet in the past, saying that he has respect for and is regularly involved in the LGBTQ plus community, knowing that he has even worked gay pride events. Now, a photo has come out that seems to prove his previous testimonies. The snapshot shows both Ola and Abel at a Chicago Pride parade several years ago. The duo were reportedly handing out condoms and flexing while shirtless and dressed as Trojan warriors as they marched in the parade and promoted the popular contraceptive brand. This bump in the road comes after the trial took another surprising turn when Smollett's defense attorney questioned a mistrial after accusing Cook County Judge James Lynn of physically lunging at her. Oh my God. All, you know what? There's a common thread with some of these lawyers and this whole mistrial shit. Some of y'all watch too much Matlock. Too much Matlock and not enough Perry Mason. Y'all be coming into court with these stunts. Oh my Lord. So lawyer Tamara Walker has been questioning Ola regarding his past use of homophobic slurs in social media posts. But WBBM-TV reported that Judge Lynn stopped the line of questioning, saying it was getting into collateral territory. Then Chicago Tribune reporter Megan Krupo tweeted, "The jury is sent out of the room and she asked for a mistrial in part because of the collateral comment." She later elaborated on the incident, adding, "Walker is also saying that Lynn lunged at her during a sidebar. You did physically lunge at me." The judge both denied the accusation and refused the request for a mistrial. Y'all. Oh, I'm sorry, but that tickled me. That whole, look, Jesse is on trial fighting for his life right now. Okay. He is fighting for his life. He really is. And oops. It's hilarious. So much is going on. So much is happening, and I'm just tickled by so much, but it's December, it's my birthday month, I will be celebrating all month. I'm also really going to chill too. Once Sagittarius season is over, I'm sitting the fuck back down. I ain't gonna hold y'all. I'm trying to figure out what I want to do for New Year's. I'm thinking about it. But I'm thinking about it. I need to figure out what I'm gonna do. Anywho. That's all the show I got for y'all today. And I'll be back or whatever. Appreciate y'all for listening. I appreciate y'all for listening to the last show and for everyone who reached out. I just appreciate you all around. Y'all are the best. I fucks with y'all for fucking with me. And yeah, you know, I'm gonna just, you know, I'm gonna be here as long as y'all want me to or whatever. And in the interim, I want y'all to take care of yourselves and wishing you the best. Okay. Thank y'all for coming. God bless y'all. Good night.